Hello and welcome to the Penn Innovators in Business series. And today we have with us Mr. Rick Bates. Rick is the CEO and founder of RxSense and also Single Care. Thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, very happy to be here.
Yes, and there's a charity that you want to highlight during this interview, and that is Heading Home. Could you tell us a little more about what this means to you?
Sure. So Heading Home is a local Boston organization that helps homeless single mothers and their children, actually provides housing for them and programs to offer support. In addition, they do a lot in the community with literally feet on the street, helping people with food supplies, housing, and education. So it's an incredibly active organization. The people who work there are they're so committed. And actually, we ended up getting very involved with them directly because my wife was actively working with them, participating, volunteering. She got members of our organization to volunteer their time as well. So RxSense has had a very strong connection. And it unfortunately, I lost my wife about a year ago. And as a result, we've really embraced Heading Home because it was incredibly important to her. We've done a number of events and been very supportive of them financially as well.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that. Tell us about how you entered this drug industry and how you first got introduced into this.
Yeah, sure. So I graduated from Wharton in 96 and had a great experience there, learned a tremendous amount about myself, and then certainly about business as well, and was very fortunate to get an opportunity to work for a fast-paced managed care organization that was really cutting edge and disruptive, and that was Oxford Health Plans, which at the time had been doing some very interesting things in the managed care space, really one of the pioneers in managed care overall. And then I just built my career really in healthcare for the first, call it 10 years, and then on the pharmaceutical side in the PBM world, and now with really, I think, disruptive model and disruptive technology at RxSense. And I found that the PBM world is actually a much more interesting business from my point of view. Healthcare is incredibly complex. And when you're trying to manage medical spend, hospital stays, really serious health concerns, there's so many moving parts, and these organizations are particularly large and cumbersome. And many of them really do a phenomenal job. And when you look at the complexity of the system, and especially those who work on a national scale. But for me, I really found that the PBM world was just something that had tremendous opportunity, was inefficient, easier to navigate and manage, and really directed my career into this space, as I mentioned, for about the last 15 years.
And just a quick explanation, PBM is Pharmacy Benefit Managers. What do they do?
Yeah, sure. So there are companies like Express Scripts and Caremark or OptumRx, which is owned by United Health Group. And basically, when you go fill a prescription at a retail pharmacy, all that data on your card is managed and sourced by one of these companies so that they manage the cost of your prescription, the allocation of your benefit program, the setup of your benefit program, and reimbursement to the pharmacies. And they typically work through other health plans if you get your prescription drug benefit from them, or they work through employer groups or other plan sponsors.
Is the understanding that they're almost like insurance for drugs?
Yes. Yeah. No, that's absolutely right. The way to look at this is they deliver your prescription drugs as part of your insurance. But to be clear, most PBMs are not actually insurance companies.
Makes sense. So you enter this industry, and what led you to jump from a very successful COO role to go into your own startup?
Yeah. So a little bit of background for me. So I spent most of my career in larger publicly traded organizations, and I learned a tremendous amount. I was able to move into roles that were really around general management and not strong functional roles and responsibilities, but really to taking over the responsibility to turn around an operating unit or build a business. In some instances, actually build a business from scratch. Now you have the means and the resources of a large organization behind you. I benefited from many great experiences in large companies, And it helped me learn the entire healthcare landscape. So I worked in on the medical side, obviously the prescription drug side, and specialty benefits as well. And you got to see how all of these pieces interact, where the opportunities are to be disruptive, innovative, and create new opportunities. So we did a fair amount of product innovation in the different jobs that I had. I was fortunate to work for many really good, smart people. I was also in these large companies. I really wasn't burdened by the bureaucracy because I was always put in roles where they were trying to get me to move a business forward and take it outside of the bureaucracy and not have to get swallowed up by internal mechanics of large organizations. I got to a place where I was the president and COO of Catalyst Health Solutions, which was really, it was a publicly traded company, but it was the smallest business that I'd worked for. And I think that's when I realized that I was best suited to actually be an entrepreneur. The plan at Catalyst was to really drive significant growth there for 3 or 4 years and then exit. And we were fortunate to be acquired by another competitor of ours. But along this path, what I was learning about myself was the things that I was best at was identifying new markets, new products, areas of inefficiency, and then developing solutions that you could take to market. I've been fortunate to have some great operating people and financial people around me that brought this stuff to life.
I think many of us hope in the future that we're going to be the head of a publicly traded company. So as a preview of that lifestyle, what is your everyday decisions like? What do you make decisions on and how do you come to a conclusion?
So in that role, I think, unfortunately, there's so much pressure around earnings that you're always looking at your quarterly numbers and building very disciplined operating plans to ensure that you can meet the objectives that you've given to Wall Street. The publicly traded jobs they're all consuming jobs. You're on all the time. And not only are you running the business, but you're also spending time with investors and telling, you know, the story about your business and the opportunities that you see in the future. It's a role where you really do learn to be very careful about the words that you use and how you communicate, and you end up tending to be very literal. And oftentimes I would say the challenge that we always had was wanting to invest at a level that was much greater than what we could invest at because we had to hit an earnings number and you had to continue to achieve your growth. So you don't have the same flexibility that you do in a privately held business. And you have an awful lot of scrutiny on your company and not all analysts love you or love what you're doing. So it was a great role. I learned a tremendous amount. It pushed me towards go build your own company. And if someday this ends up as a public company, that would be great as well. That's not my objective today. And I do think it's become harder and harder to run public companies as well. Some people may disagree with that, but it's an incredibly complicated reporting structure and all of the partnership that you have to do with the analysts and communication to your investors is becoming even more critical than it was when I left that 10 years ago.
I see. So yes, then you moved on to start RxSense.
Yeah. So the real decisions here, and I'll be very candid, and I've been fortunate to have done fairly well in the transaction when we sold Catalyst Health Solutions. So I now had my own capital that I could invest and put into starting a business. And I had a couple of other early stage partners who had, you know, done a number of startups and either participated by loaning folks debt or providing some equity and partnership. So we did not have to raise outside capital. So just to be really clear about this transition, so I'm 50 years old, right? I started this business 6 years ago. And a lot of times people have a perspective that an entrepreneur is somebody right out of grad school or they've worked for 3 or 4 or 5 years and then they want to go start something and be super disruptive. But certainly there's a lot of truth to that. But I think if you read a lot of recent materials, the average age of entrepreneurs is actually people are getting older, leveraging experiences that they've had, learnings about how to run a business, how to look at markets, how to get expertise in an industry. Oftentimes, my experience is where I learned what others weren't doing well, and that enabled me to look at something to create opportunities. It isn't just about looking at people that are really successful or making things work. You can learn an awful lot from a bad example. The transition for me was not dependent on outside capital, which is a very significant challenge for many people to get investors to buy into their ideas. And I also think that if I had chosen the route of raising capital, just given my age, experience, and track record, it would have been a much easier thing to do at 44 than it would have been at 30 or 35. So I'm not discouraging anybody from trying to be a young entrepreneur, but I would also tell you that there is a balance. I learned a ton about how to be a better operator, a better manager, a better listener, a better leader through my experiences working in larger organizations. Mm-hmm. And the leap to build RxSense was I had some expertise in the industry. I wanted to build a new and unique and disruptive model. I spent about a year on the phone with a lot of the retail pharmacies that we had partnered with in the past. So as you can imagine, it's Walmart, Walgreens, CVS, Kroger stores. And my thought process was, how can I build a direct relationship with the pharmacies, not be dependent on a PBM, and create opportunities to drive savings for consumers, better price points for consumers, and had some experience in this space before. So I had a pretty good model. We understood the level of investment we needed to make, what the payback would be, and all that. And we were able to get the business off the ground faster than you would think. Now, it cost us more than we had anticipated, and it took a little bit longer. But generally speaking, we had this business cash flow positive and profitable after it would have been about 30 months. And that's a huge metric, right? You can't just keep burning cash. You've got to figure out how to get your business self-sustaining.
And so this is so interesting. So regularly, if I wanted to get a drug, I would go to the pharmacy, CVS, and I would say that I need the drug. And then usually I have an insurance and I would pay my portion of the copay, but I have no idea what the actual price of the drug is because the insurance company, they have an agreement with these PBMs, which are like, and I don't know what's going on, but I pay my copay. But what RxSense and later SingleCare want to do is to make it more transparent.
Yeah. So we have, just to be really clear for everybody, we have two distinct businesses. One is SingleCare, which is GoodRx's largest competitor and offers full transparency around what the cost of a drug is by pharmacy, by dosage, day's supply, all of that. Mm-hmm. And you can compare it to your insurance. You can compare it to the pharmacy's cash price, and you have all that information that we've made available to you. We do the same thing on the other part of our business, which is an enterprise platform solution. So it's the engine that PBMs can run on, or large employer groups, or third-party administrators. Anybody could take our technology and run their pharmacy benefits off of it. We have the expertise to deliver you all the capabilities that you need, but it's a way of giving enterprises the ability to have their own control over their pharmacy benefits if they want to do that. And we're the most modern and innovative platform in the industry. So there are some established companies running on legacy platforms that would like to have modern tech and to simplify their experience delivering services or data and analytics or cost of goods to any of their customers. And in both instances, transparency of cost and providing best price is, I think, just a foundational tenet of what we do as an organization.
And that's so interesting that you mentioned the technological innovation inside the drug industry seems to be very, very slow. Like things that are in my head of the drug industry are very rudimentary, not very tech enabled. Why is that?
So here's what I think's happened across most of the healthcare landscape is you've had all this complexity that's been built over the years, right? And it's all been done on legacy systems that are still really inefficient and expensive to maintain. They aren't very flexible and they don't work well for innovation. But the organizations, they're the largest players, these are Fortune 50 companies, right? And they certainly have the means to figure out how to innovate on the tech side. It's just the complexity of it. It's hard to come up with a cost-benefit analysis that's going to enable somebody like, just think of how big CVS Health is today, right? To modernize all of Caremark's legacy platforms. So it's super expensive. It would take a very long time. And often, even efforts at modernizing on a minimal basis, right, just making some improvements, have not yielded great performance results. So there's just been this hesitancy to make massive investments to drive innovation. And to just to be clear, the things that we're doing as a company feel disruptive, they feel innovative in the industry that we're in, but they are absolutely the same exact things that people are doing in all other industries, especially if you're in the digital space, right? I tell everybody, even all of our prospects, I said, this, it may be hard to believe that this is the way our business operates and our platform runs, but you have to understand, this is the way most industries run today. It's just healthcare has not, you know, made the technology investments necessary to modernize, create flexibility, really innovate and be disruptive. Now, there obviously are smaller businesses on the periphery who've done that very well. But in terms of the largest players, they're burdened with this legacy tech.
This is so interesting. There was recently an article by McKinsey that said most of a huge portion of GDP growth comes from first world countries bringing their technology to third world countries. But in this case, I think, yes, there are industries that are bringing their technology into other industries that are increasing growth as well.
Yeah, that's really what we've done. We went and hired a whole bunch of super smart people that have never worked in our industry before. Mm-hmm. And we married them with people who understand product and benefit design and all the specifics of the prescription drug space.
The other question I had was, why isn't there delivery service for drugs? Like, why doesn't Amazon go into the drug delivery business?
So they actually have. There's more home delivery for prescription drugs than people realize. So for many years, for decades, it was all mail order facilities. And you would sign up for your benefits. And then you had the option to have your drugs filled through mail order and shipped to your house, which most people would do if they had serious chronic conditions and they just knew they needed their meds to be refilled every month, or if they got a 90-day supply and had it refilled every quarter. What's, I think, come to light during the pandemic is that mail order wasn't used by, I think the statistics are, it's roughly 10% of the population would get their scripts filled through mail order. People do actually, human behavior is hard to change. People like to go to the pharmacy. They want to talk to their pharmacist. You have a disproportionate number of prescription drugs that are taken by the Medicare population than you do by the pre-65 working commercial insured, right? And when you have retirees, part of this could be, and when we talk about changing human behavior, so many of them are just used to going to the pharmacy, right? That's how they've always gotten their drugs. And then during the pandemic, of course, nobody wanted to go out. In so many states, especially if you were up here up in the Northeast corridor, things went into lockdown pretty quickly. And the pharmacies had to accelerate their home delivery or curbside pickup or even the efficiency of their drive-through operations. Mm-hmm. And we have done quite a bit of that as well. We've been working with two partners to add home delivery as a capability for our business. We've always done it on the enterprise platform side. We want to do it on the consumer part of the business as well. Mm-hmm. And I do think that home delivery is going to continue to grow. But we also have to remember that you can go see your doctor and you can get a prescription. And let's just say they send it electronically to the pharmacy. Well, you can go pick it up in 15 minutes or half an hour, whatever it is. If you want it delivered to your home, there's all this talk about we can get a drug to you in 45 minutes and this is the way the world's going to change. and drones are going to deliver drugs to your home. I think that's quite a ways off. And we also have to be realistic that there's a significant percentage of drugs that cost less than $10. So home delivery, you would be an additional expense that the consumer would have to incur. Today, because of the pandemic, pharmacies are absorbing a lot of that cost. And I do believe the model will continue to evolve, but I don't think that retail pharmacies are going to die and have all these terrible potential threats. I just think they're going to have to modify. They're in the best position to provide home delivery, quite frankly, especially those with the largest footprints, which are Walgreens and CVS.
How do you see COVID-19 changing the landscape of healthcare in the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah. So I think what we've seen is some pretty extreme lift in a couple of areas in the short term, like telehealth, like home delivery for prescription drugs, a significant reduction in doctor's visits and elective procedures. And that, I think, was a kind of a one-time reaction to the threat of COVID-19 and the uncertainty and the concerns and all. And much of that has recovered, albeit not 100%. I think, and statistics are showing that telehealth volume, which really spiked and was at its peak performance through second quarter, has tempered quite a bit and is only up modestly over pre-pandemic levels. And to be clear, I think telehealth is a great offering. I just don't think the world's going to move to specific to the largest established telehealth providers today. I think what we're seeing is you'll be able to have a telehealth visit with your pediatrician or your family practitioner or OBGYN or podiatrist or whoever, right? Mm-hmm. And it will be reimbursed by your insurance company as though it was a real visit, okay? I'm not inclined to get on telehealth and just have a random doc. I am inclined to have a video chat with my own personal family practitioner, right? Mm-hmm. So I do think we're going to see a meaningful shift, but the way I refer to this is it's video visits, and it's going to be with the doctors that you have established relationships with, right? I think there's going to be even more importance around transparency of the price, you know, the cost that you're going to pay. We're in a situation where I feel like the stock market is totally disconnected from the underlying economy. I think the economy is going to be, you know, much slower to recover. And we're going to have many millions of Americans who have lost their health insurance and are going to be very focused on the actual cost of care. And there's going to be more cash pay for all services. So not just prescription drugs, but I just think the marketplace today is going to have some longer term effects of this loss of insurance, the continued challenges around cost of care, the need for even more transparency. And that's both on the prescription drug side and certainly on the medical side. And then I'm also of the opinion that when you go for a period of time without healthcare, you will reassess what you think are essential services or not, right? So we may see that there are more elective procedures that get put off and that you don't have the same volume of. And I think that's probably going to be even more true if the country enters a much longer term recession.
Wait, so what would that mean? Who are the winners and the losers in that case?
So unfortunately, I think that the American consumer is generally going to be more of the loser in this, as you hate to see people who lose their insurance. You hate to see wage stagnation and unemployment rise. We're going to have to figure out a model that does a better job managing costs or creating at least transparency and understanding, are people in the system using their healthcare coverage or are they out of the system and paying cash? Hospitals, especially suburban hospitals, are always going to do well. Not that they're extraordinarily profitable, but I don't think they're going to be nearly as threatened as a lot of the rural hospitals will be, especially if you're in cities that are recovering faster than some of the kind of second or third tier cities, you know, in terms of the economy recovering. I do think that the drug companies are going to find themselves more in a position of influence and having and being viewed more positively than they have been in recent years. They get so much heat around the cost of drugs and drug pricing. I think that the country is hopefully beginning to see the value of having all of these great companies that are racing right now to find treatments and vaccines and really just change the landscape for everyone. And if we didn't have this infrastructure, we didn't have all of the investment in research and development, we wouldn't be anywhere close to where we are in terms of progress has been made in improving treatments, reducing deaths, and hopefully having a few really viable vaccines that we'll have great confidence in by the end of the year, even if they haven't really finished their human trials. And certainly they probably won't be in mass production until sometime the first quarter.
I see. But do you think this will be very detrimental to insurers as there's less healthcare people who are in healthcare?
No, it's unfortunately, here's what's happening. Insurance companies are going to outperform the market because they take on full risk for all of the medical care, right? Mm-hmm. And when you have less care, you're going to have much higher margins, right? Mm-hmm. That isn't necessarily going to return itself it's not going to return funds to the consumer. Because as you look forward into the future, there will be assumptions that are made that costs will come back. The benefit of the low utilization during the pandemic won't last. I don't think there's going to be a big break on insurance premiums. It may moderate a little bit, and we might find 2021 is just a few points higher than 2020. And quite candidly, this year, and not to get into too much detail on insurance, but if you're a large employer and you manage your own benefits and you're self-funded, so you don't pay an insurance premium, you just manage the risk yourself, mm-hmm. you'll have a better year and lower costs, but it isn't going to be meaningful enough to change the future projection of costs for the company. I look at where we are right now as more of a one-time event. It may last 9 more months, but it's not going to change the curves or the pattern.
I see. The next question is, what is one lesson that you use every day?
So I learned this actually at Wharton. I think at that point in my career, I was more sure of myself and my answers and thinking that kind of gotten myself through life based on my own work ethic and determination, and I know the answer. And the lesson that I learned right away at Wharton was, you don't always know the answer. Even if you have an answer that works, there are 9 other great ways that you can look at solving a problem. And it's super important to surround yourself with people who have different points of view and to demonstrate to them that you're willing to listen and figuring out how to collaborate and find the most optimal solution. I guess in summary, it's make sure you're incredibly aware of all the different scenarios that could solve a problem. And then have the humility to redirect if you make a decision and you're moving down a path and you're wrong, right? And that happens quite often in business. And it isn't that you have to stop and start over. It's, hey, we got this 80%. We need to make some changes. We need to modify things. So don't be so proud of the decision that you made that you lose sight of. Like I've watched many executives make a decision. It's a wrong decision and they run it right into the ground because they're afraid of being wrong. And I think the bravest thing you can do is don't worry about being wrong. Worry about getting it right eventually, right? I'm sure Jeff Bezos didn't think Amazon was going to end up being what it is today, right? He did. You want to talk about somebody that has just looked at markets in every different way and reassessed and modified and been willing to change direction. So that I think is critical to your long-term success.
Interesting. Is there an example from your personal journey that reflects that?
Yeah. So I'll tell you right now, we started SingleCare as a healthcare services company. And I've been fortunate to have worked in so many different parts of the industry that I just reached out to many people that I've worked with in the past. And we had a national medical offering and a national dentist offering, dental program offering. Same with vision and eyeglasses and prescription drugs. And we just thought we're going to build the best consumer experience for full transparency, affordability, and access for healthcare across the country. That was the original vision of the business. And it turns out that most physicians don't want to take cash. They're just billing machines for the large insurance companies, which I understand and have a lot of respect for how they needed to build these walls and capabilities so that they can fight back against the insurance reimbursements. Dentists are a pretty impressive group of entrepreneurs, and about half of their business ends up being cash pay. So they really weren't that interested in working with us because we built this whole system and infrastructure where the dentist was actually paying us, think of it as a referral fee, right? So we were, quote, taking some money out of their pockets. And then we didn't have much success on the vision side. There actually are a lot of good solutions there. And I sat down and I just said to myself, what am I doing? This is, I just pushed this crazy vision and got myself outside of my core original business model. And we just need to turn this stuff off, stop investing in it, and be totally focused on the pharmacy space, and then build a model that really understands how to go leverage technology and be the owner of our technology, be vertically integrated as a company. Mm-hmm. And that took me 18 months, and we probably spent $6 or $7 million screwing that up. But I could have held my gun, stuck to my guns. I could have gone out, raised a bunch of money, found some people who would buy into this and run the business at a huge loss. And it just didn't make sense. But here's the thing. My reaction to that was, okay, I've now learned a great lesson. It's time for me to be even more pointed in our strategy, more specific, and you know, redirect the company. So thank God I did that, because things have been working fairly well for us over the last few years. Mm-hmm. But it was a tough decision. I mean, it was tough to look in the mirror and say to yourself, oh, you fool, come on, slow this stuff down and do what you're best at and stick to that, you know? So if you were to ask me what are like the biggest low points that I've had since starting this company, I would have to tell you, I don't think I've had my lowest point yet, because you just never know what could happen and your expectations change and everything. But it always is a battle. Business is always competitive. I love what I do and I have great people and wake up with a ton of energy every day. But having said that, there just are new challenges that are always emerging and tough decisions that you have to make. And the last point I'd also mention on this is the hardest decisions to me early in my career were always about, are we doing the right thing either strategically or operationally? And it was about execution and performance. And I would tell you that in the last 10 years of my career, the hardest decisions that I've had to make are always about people, especially people who've been super loyal and incredibly committed. And sometimes the business outgrows what their capabilities are. Sometimes I haven't had the right people in the right roles. So you move them into the right role and enable them to be successful, but it's inconsistent with where they saw their career going. So the challenge is, I think as you go through life and build your career, your challenges change as I think maybe as your responsibilities change.
That answer had so many interesting highlights. The last question I had was, what is your advice moving forward, looking for a job, looking for a career, defining their future? What is your advice?
The most important things that you guys can do is find something that you're passionate about and be willing to take risks when you're early in your career, because it isn't going to stick with you. And I've been fired twice, right? And one time I just couldn't stand my boss. And then the other time, the CEO that I worked for, he was fired, and then they wiped out the management team. And it didn't define me. It didn't hurt me. It didn't even frustrate me. It was just, okay, it's what am I doing next? So I think the thing here is risk, especially when you're young, is very manageable. So the most important thing that I found in my career is if you're passionate about what you do, you're going to be so much better at it. And I have experiences where I got a great job. It paid really well. I wasn't passionate about it. It wasn't the right fit for me. So I did it to the best of my ability and then was looking for something that was going to be better. And you can't always control your own destiny, right? As many of you who want to be entrepreneurs, that many of you will be very successful. Many of you will learn great lessons, but the business won't materialize the way you want it to. And many of you may end up just working for larger companies for most of your career. And all of that's fine. But the key is you have to be in an organization that you have a shared value system with, because if you don't, then you're not going to feel like you fit in with the culture. You're not going to feel supported. You'll probably be conflicted. So organizations do have cultures, right? And you want to be around really good people. You want to be in an organization that's committed to your development. You want to be in an organization that encourages you to take risk as well. So I think those are, maybe some of you think those are a little idealistic. I would tell you throughout my career, I wish I'd listened to that advice earlier. And I wouldn't have made as many mistakes. To learn how to do really well, to put yourself in the best situation you can, and continue to try to meet more people, learn about opportunities, and also expand your comfort zone. You might find something that is an industry or there's a market opportunity that you weren't aware of that you'd find to be tremendously that was not on your radar. And you guys should really leverage the alumni network. My experience is that Wharton alums have been very loyal to one another, and you should really go through the alumni network, look at the industries you like, and use that to the best of your advantage.
Wow. Thank you so much. That's great, great advice.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening, and make sure to check out more content and subscribe to our podcast.